And we're back with an all-new episode of Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III.
I'm Louis Fertel, and on Zoom today, I am wearing, for some reason, a white sweatshirt I bought at some bar event. It has MGM on it, but the lighting here is also bright white, so I look like I'm trying out for some low-budget Emily Dickinson movie or something.
You always look like Casper.
Okay, but today it's looking like literary Casper. So I look like I'm writing poems to myself that I'm shoving in a cabinet.
All right. Emily Dickinson today. That's you. That's you.
Yeah.
You know what?
But not an Emily Dickinson that gets on Hulu. Is that what network that's on?
No, it's on Apple, baby.
I truly am not good at getting those organized.
Dickinson's cute. It's Hailee Steinfeld. I've seen season one.
She's a fucking great actress. Yeah.
Yeah.
I saw season one also. Yeah. Yes.
And you know, it's just trippy. Here's the thing. I'm not really watching anything on Apple. Unfortunately.
Can I tell you something?
Unfortunately.
Because I don't know if this is just because of the sheer amount of television there is. So many shows I just need one season of. Like, I will watch Girls 5 Eva, but it's sort of like I got what I wanted out of the show already, so I don't need to continue with it. This is a mental block I have with a lot of television right now. You know, you get the initial log line, which you can tell why it's sold, and it's very good, and then you watch the show, and then we're done, you know? I guess this is why we have the advent of the limited series.
Is that because you think that these shows are too half-serialized? Like, they're not, if Girls 5 Eva was just sitcom each week, like it was the same thing, like a Frasier, you know, like I feel like we have a dearth of those shows on TV.
Yeah, but and of course then we'll just get those rebooted too, so there's too much of everything.
Okay. No, I mean, I think I've said this before, I miss the era of you just tune in, you laugh. I feel like that's why people like Abbott Elementary. It's, you know,
yeah,
it's lightly serialized.
You don't have to keep up with the narrative.
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And
yeah.
You can sort of just pop in whenever, you know? And I think we need literally more sitcoms. It's what I miss.
I just want someone to say bazinga at me, and then I go to sleep from 7:30 p.m. to 7:30 a.m.
Yeah. You know, we just need Neil Patrick Harris pretending to be straight, making misogynistic jokes.
Can I say something about Neil Patrick Harris? I root for his actually evil turn where he hosts like an Ellen's Game of Games type thing. and it's like, because I feel like he's one of these people who, gays in particular, are like, all right, we've had enough of you or whatever. And I would like him to revolt against that and just become like a nightmare gay in pop culture.
Well, so you know, I was a writer and producer on Neil Patrick Harris's upcoming show, Uncoupled, which
Correct.
Is Darren Star's new show. This is his first time playing gay and staying alive. Okay, if you're at an AIDS show, that virus is like Ghostface. All right.
Okay.
You get a phone call and it's like.
What's your favorite scary movie? Longtime Companion.
The Normal Heart. Absolutely terrifying. Yeah.
Julia Slade in that movie.
So it's not his first time playing gay, but you know, he's playing gay in a romantic comedy sitcom, you know? And I think people will be interested in how good he is in it. And just sort of how it's something new for him. He's also, by the way, very good in Into the Woods, which I saw this weekend at New York City Encore.
Right, of course he's in it.
It was only a 2-week run, which I feel like people always forget about New York City Center Encores because it's always just sort of like a 2-week run of you know, a revival of sort of like a show that we haven't seen, you know, in years or something. Like Billy Porter directed a revival of The Life, which felt like the death.
I love when you become somebody who wrote for Variety in 1947. Anyway.
Baby, the show should have stayed dead. Let's just say that.
Okay. There we go. The box office was not bothered. Yeah.
The Life, I saw no signs of it. I don't. I'm gonna stop beating this show to death.
I wish you would beat it to life. Yeah. So on today's show, we're going to interview, for the hell of it, another fucking legend. Sometimes when these people pop into the Zoom, Ira and I basically exchange a look, which you can't really do over Zoom. But Sissy Spacek showed up and it was like, what is happening? Sissy Spacek is here. Oscar winner, legend, coal miner's daughter. I mean, there's plenty of things we can say about Sissy Spacek, and we get into those today. We also, for the hell of it, investigate a couple of Sissy Spacek blind spots we have. I watched The Straight Story and Three Women. What did you watch, Ira?
I watched Badlands. And
oh, great.
Wildly enough, I watched In the Bedroom for the first time.
Oh, I'm sure you lived.
Yeah, oof, I did.
There are some moments in that.
I did.
And of course, we get into In the Bedroom with Sissies, too. If you've not seen Todd Field's 2001 masterpiece recently, you will be doing that after this podcast. And then also, we're going to get into Eurovision because, you know, gay people be talking.
And singing.
And singing. You said that like Michigan Joe Frog.
Coming up next, Sarah Michelle Gellar and Courtney Cox.
But first, a jig. Yes.
All right, we'll be back with more Keep It. On Saturday, the Eurovision Song Contest 2022 held its final performances in Italy, and the winner was Ukraine with the song Stefania, performed by Parappa the Rapper.
Did you know that it's the first song ever with quote-unquote hip-hop elements to win Eurovision? Which sounds like when you hear, oh, there's finally a female Latin cast member on SNL. Like, how is that possible?
Hip-hop elements. I'm using air quotes because this truly was like Cypress Hill-esque 90s white men rapping elements.
I was going to say, that is actually generous. I was going to say Snow Informer. It was giving a licky boom boom down.
The UK, Spain, Sweden, and Serbia rounded out the top five. And let's just get this out of the way. Spain was robbed. And I have had it.
Okay, that girl was on
Chanel.
Fire. Chanel.
I have had it with pussy popping gay anthems getting to the top three on Eurovision and not winning.
I feel the same way about Eurovision that most people allegedly feel about the Oscars, which is the thing I love never wins. Like, I'm watching it and I'm like, oh, we all love this, you know, gay ass pop music, right? And then gay comes in fourth.
Yeah,
you know, I get upset.
And then it's this weird reminder that like straight Europeans love Eurovision too,
which is sick.
Yeah, and so they're not voting.
They haven't
earned voting
it.
For the best. Chanel. I mean, this is,
we should say about this Chanel woman. So Spain's entry is this woman who is mostly an actress in Spain, and she, of course. Like, maybe most Spain entries in Eurovision is dressed in, like, a spangled leotard with, like, a light matador touch in the coat. You can picture it. And the song itself is giving Pussycat Dolls.
Yeah.
It reminds me of, it's like if they had a follow-up single to React, which, of course, they didn't.
Yeah. COVID sort of killed the Pussycat Dolls, didn't it? Like, they like Oliver and Company, they're out in the streets.
Yeah. Curiosity did not kill the Pussycat Dolls. It was COVID. Yeah.
I'm actually friends with this Canadian pop singer, Maggie Zabo, who wrote the song for Chanel.
Oh.
And it is an anthem. And it reminds me of, you know, the last Eurovision contest, Eleni Farou. For Cyprus, who had that song Fuego, if you remember that song.
Yes, great
like,
song.
The gays keep getting songs to be obsessed with, and yet we're denied.
Toy by Netta, that was one that won, that was for us. There are occasions, you know, and of course, Waterloo by ABBA is the definitive Eurovision winner.
Toy is a very good gay pop song, but also Toy beat Fuego. So, you know,
they can't all
I'd rather have the pussy popper than, you know, the song with the message behind it, which is I'm not your toy, not your toy oi, which, you know, we learned about that in grade school.
And I would rather have both of those than a pussy parappa, which we just explained earlier.
Cool.
Parappa the Rapper. What an amazing reference from PlayStation 1. Waterloo, the lyric in it, the finally facing my Waterloo, as in just the idea of, oh, this person I'm obsessed with is my Waterloo. It's such a sweet sentiment. It's such an all-time great analogy. So I think it's a good definitive winner for Eurovision to have. Sweden this year, speaking of which, the girl who performed, she got in the top five or so, and her song was fine and catchy. She herself was so styled exactly Swedish, and yet also was a hybrid of Julianne Hough and Kaylee Cuoco, that she was exactly unmemorable.
Mm. It is worth mentioning that the Sam Ryder from the UK actually topped the jury's scoreboard, but was overtaken by the Ukraine when the public votes were added, which this was kind of expected, to be honest. I thought Ukraine was going to win Eurovision anyway, because, I mean, they're being invaded.
Yes.
By Russia. And of
also,
course,
it's not that the song is unlistenably like uncatchy or anything. There are good pop music elements to it, but I thought it was a very competitive year otherwise. You know, like the top five all stand out in certain ways. Even like Serbia, I enjoyed. It's interesting. If we're talking about the best of the best, it's weird that it ended up at number one.
Yeah. I mean, not to be crass, but it's giving sympathy and payola.
Yeah. Payola, my favorite word.
This also was the year where they've decided that I guess they're gonna start overhauling the jury vote situation next year, because there were a bunch of votes that were off screen. What always happens is that when the announcements come in and there are you know, the 40 countries that are competing, there's always, you know, a representative from that country who gets on the screen to say how many points they're awarding, like who's going to get their 12 points, right? Like Courtney Act represented Australia. And it's usually just a parade of people in weird outfits and fun accents.
Right, taking too long to say hello before they get to the points.
That, by the way, I am obsessed, and I know this is probably just like like an American joke about how like Europeans speak, but I am obsessed with how, especially the announcers, like they always sort of like say a weird statement that's almost sort of a joke, but isn't really, and then they follow it up with, okay, wow, you know, or it's like a, okay.
Right, no. They almost have a quip, and then there's a long pause, and then they get to the rigmarole of the points, which always takes too fucking long.
All right.
Again, they're getting through 40 questions and just a tally.
It's always, all right, let's get to the points. It's like, all right, we could have done that first.
From the country of Mario Kart, here is,
There are several who weren't on the screen. Because I guess there was a scandal about countries promising to vote for one another in an effort to, I don't know, like keep another country from winning, which I feel like happens every fucking year because it's Eurovision. Countries are competing against one another, and I wouldn't think that alliances between countries would vanish in the midst of a song contest.
No, even though I guess, you know, spiritually that's what's supposed to happen. Like, let's just get together and love pop music and pick the best, but absolutely not. That's not what happens. Like, Greece and Cyprus are always voting for each other and stuff.
Yeah.
I just want to say also that always somebody on Twitter will be like, what's Eurovision? Some gay guy will do that. You can't play dumb about Eurovision anymore. We have a whole Will Ferrell movie about it. So stop pretending you haven't heard of it.
Which?
It's a big stupid, expensive X Factor finale, and we invite Croatia. Okay? That's what it is.
And we tried to replicate it this year with the American Song Contest, which I did not watch.
Oh, my God. Well, that makes you anybody.
But Michael Bolton was in it.
Macy Gray was in it.
Yeah. So congrats to everyone.
They tried.
A K-pop song won.
Oh, okay. Cute. Good
job. And that's as much as I know about it. Kelly Clarkson hosted it. And listen, I support her. But I largely do not know what she does with her day. If you ask me what happens on the Kelly Clarkson show, I'm like, I don't know. She probably sang a cover of a pop song from 3 years ago and then talked to somebody.
That's exactly right. because I'm friends with Matt Rogers, these clips are funneled to me as if I'm in a subscription service, and I'm not. Just yesterday, I watched Kelly Clarkson perform with Ann Wilson of Hearts Ann Wilson, and they sounded great. Wonderful. They always do an abridged version of the song, which upsets me. Mm. But Kelly Clarkson hosting the show, I'm always obsessed with somebody having a hit thing they do, and then for 1 year, they're also stuck doing this other thing that's not a hit. For a while, Ryan Seacrest hosted this game show called Million Second Quiz, where people played trivia all night. You could watch it all 24 hours a day. And he would host the primetime hour of it. You know, meanwhile, he's hosting American Idol 2 or whatever. And it's just, girl, what are you doing? And you're on with Regis and Kelly. I don't know if he was on with Regis and Kelly then, or with Kelly Ripa then. But it's just so funny to watch somebody who's successful do something contractually that is not successful.
Speaking of Eurovision, America's Eurovision was this weekend, the Billboard Awards.
My favorite award show, because it's not about votes, it's about
sales.
Well, have you seen the charts recently? We're gonna put an award in front of that. It's the Good Job Awards.
There's always like a controversy with like people being like, oh, I wish this person would win, and people being like, well, you know, it's because of sales.
Yeah. They literally can tell them beforehand who won.
Yeah,
just based on what's on the
okay,
chart.
You know who's not winning? Lord. Doja Cat's winning everything.
Right. By the way, can I just say about Lord, that clip of her going viral, where like someone put together a smash, I was a supercut, LOL, of her shushing the audience as she sings either a cappella or sings something in a concert, and they're trying to sing along, so she's shushing them. Why don't more people in concert do that? I assume when people are singing all the words at you, you can't hear what you're singing. I'm surprised to see she's the only person to do that.
I mean, Donna Summer said, shut up, faggots, and everyone called her homophobic for decades. So maybe that's why people stopped doing it, Lewis.
Oh, okay. People really misinterpreted that as homophobic. It was supportive. Yeah.
She was like, shh, I can't hear the lyrics to Bad Girls, okay?
I can't hear God, my one true ally. Yes.
Actually, I would say that like I've seen Rina Sawayama in concert like a couple times, and she does a funny bit where she's like, are you ready to slay, like at the beginning of the concert? And then like the audience is like, yeah. And then she goes, shh, shut the fuck up, and goes into her song, Shut the Fuck Up.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
All right. No, Madonna used to be hostile with her audiences.
Yeah,
too.
I know. She didn't turn the AC on.
That
showing up 3 hours late.
Over the years, it became torture. Yes, yeah.
That bitch is later.
She's like, you can't eat. You can't know where your friends are. Yeah,
that bitch is later than me to a lunch date for her own concert. Okay, you're just sitting there, and it was even worse when she started locking up our phones like she did for the Madame X tour. You're like, I don't even know what time it is. Is it 4 a.m.? Am I still waiting for Madonna? The Billboard Awards are only memorable. Truly forgot that they were happening. They're only, I feel like, being talked about now because Megan Thee Stallion was stalked by Cara Delevingne.
What happened?
Have you seen the clips?
Oh, that's right. I saw.
But
first of all, Cara Delevingne, I understand this is what makes her a model. The resting look on her face really is demon. I mean, she's like a demon.
I think Carrie O'Donnell tweeted that Cara Delevingne needs an exorcism.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just journalistically accurate.
It is wild to me that this woman has had so many wild moments in like pop culture, and still just sort of like, does she still model?
Right, or act? She was in that one movie.
She was in Suicide Squad, which was
Suicide Squad.
One of the which is the worst acting I've ever seen in my life. And she was in a she was in a relationship with Ashley Benson, the Pretty Little Liar, slash also she used to play Abby Devereaux on Days of Our Lives, which is why I love Ashley Benson so fondly. But they were like engaged at one point, and I remember during COVID they were caught bringing like a sex swing, like a sex bench into their house.
Naughty.
Yeah,
okay,
you know,
great.
Naughty lesbians.
I instinctively root for any woman who brings me Christina Ricci eyes because she was so formative to me, and I believe in that, you know, resting angst, which is important in actresses. I feel like we haven't had as much of that recently. Yeah. But the thing that went viral, which is her standing around a corner peering at Megan Thee Stallion, and then later sitting behind her,
sitting next
during
to her.
The show and talking
she
to her.
She's peering around the corner like on the red carpet at Megan, and then she comes and like grabs the train of her dress and is throwing it up in the air, I guess, so the photos look better. It also wasn't clear whether or not she came with Megan as her plus one.
Yeah, which that's an interesting duo.
Which I think maybe she did, and then she was like, oh no, this bitch is crazy. Because the wildest part of the video is when they're sitting next to each other, and like Megan's having a conversation with Doja Cat, who's sitting in front of her, and then Kara pops into frame, and you could hear Doja Cat say like that woman's full government name. She's like, "Oh my God, hi Cara Delevingne," which is how you address someone when you are absolutely terrified by their presence.
Yeah. It's a fearful reaction, yeah. And of course, Kara is darting her neck out in that, like, attentive alley cat way.
And she, there's also video of her like crawling on the floor, taking like angled photos of Doja and the people that she's with. I'm just like, this woman was slithering all over the Billboard Music Awards, and it reminded me of last Halloween in New York, when I went to this party thrown by the Misshapes at the Box, it was Azealia Banks was one of the hosts of it, and she performed on stage. And Cara Delevingne appeared on stage wasted, taking like a mic, like trying to sing along the 212, didn't know the words, and then started like
a song that is very wordy.
And then, and then started licking like Azealia's boots.
That's too bad.
Azealia Banks doesn't deserve that. She is the poet laureate of our generation.
Right, yes. And one of the few, I would say, intimidating celebrities.
I love her.
There are just certain people like Megan Fox. I'm afraid.
I love how she sends just like white gays into a tizzy. Whenever you try to have an argument with like a certain type of white gay about her, it's always, she called us the KKK. And I'm like, I'm sorry, but she called you she said the LGBT community in parentheses, GGGG. Are like the gay white KKKs, get them some pink hoods and unicorns and let them rally down Rodeo Drive. How can you not cackle at that?
Also, I can just picture it. I mean, it's a vivid image.
To be insulted by Azealia Banks is a gift. To be like in the list of like beefs that Azealia Banks has is truly a gift. And I'm honestly, you know, kind of sad that like the reason that she blocked me on Instagram isn't public knowledge. Right. We talked about her on the show once, and she DM'd me and was like, aren't you that faggot who was talking about me on your podcast, in parentheses, the brokest form of media, which is funny.
Yes. Well, it's, I mean, it's not the richest form. I mean, you do have to root for, honestly, any celebrity who is extemporaneously super funny and not copying anyone. It's not contrived. Like her sense of humor is very ingrained in her. And even though it's extremely rowdy, that's also what makes it interesting. I don't know. It just, it, like, she has a real point of view is what I'm saying. Yeah. So you can't not root for that, I guess. She, I mean, is of course a bit messy. And of course, I think still has zero albums, but I root for her.
I root for her. I don't care if you call me a nobody, Azalea Banks. I am a nobody. On the brokest form of media, right. Unblock me.
The brokest form of media.
Unblock me. All right. When we're back, we are joined by the legend, Sissy Spacek. You will know her from many things, from her iconic role as Carrie to her Oscar-winning role in The Coal Miner's Daughter. And you can see her next in the Amazon original series Night Sky. We're absolutely thrilled to welcome to Keep It, the legendary Sissy Spacek. In this, and I feel like in so many of your works, you're portraying, you know, a marriage going through something. You know, there's this, this in the bedroom, this missing, which I guess you weren't married. But how have you been able to, I guess, make each relationship that you portray on screen feel different and fresh, especially considering I know you met your husband while making Badlands, and you've been together ever since. Yeah. So I feel like that must also come into play when you're, you know, portraying a character.
Yes, and that's kind of was my prototype, my relationship with Jack. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you go through so much together in all that time that you're, you know, it's a really deep and abiding love, but you also want to pinch the heads off sometimes. So if you understand, you still love somebody and want to strangle them.
When I think about many of your roles, it's not just that they're like incredible to watch and that they've stood up over the test of time. I would really call a lot of these performances risky. Like when I watch Carrie, it's like, I don't know that I saw, like, I can't compare it to a performance that came before it, for example. So I felt like if I were cast in that role, I would think I basically have to invent something new for the screen in order for this to work. Do you consider a lot of what you've done to be risk-taking in any way? And do you have any particular favorite risks you've taken?
Carrie was certainly a risk. I was very young then, and I would send my scripts to my parents and just to let them read and see what I was doing. And they were a little stunned, but you know, but they didn't want to interfere. And who knew? I mean, it makes you work really hard because you think, we all thought working on Carrie that it would either work or it would be the end of us. And that's, there's some fear can be very motivating.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, but I loved that. I learned a lot, you know, because my husband, Jack Fisk, who I met on Badlands, was also the production designer on Carrie. And I got into his research and studied the Dore etchings of the Bible. And so, you know, came up. Kind of copied all of those facial expressions and melodramatic facial expressions of lions eating people. And so, you know, it was fun. It's fun to do things that are a little bit bigger than life. Of course, I don't know if this is like that, if Night Sky is... At the core of Night Sky is that relationship. And that, so that's where we started from. And then we just hoped that the other would unfold.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd know it.
Well, I mean, speaking of working with Jack on Carrie, I mean, I know you worked just brief. You've mentioned that you worked briefly with him on Phantom of the Paradise, which was De Palma as well. Just from that experience and knowing De Palma, like on set, how did you were you happy to be going into Carrie? Were you sort of like, oh, that movie, I guess it wasn't as well received as Carrie was as well. Did you have any trepidation about doing this role, or were you just very excited to be taking on like the Stephen King novel?
Well, because I worked on Phantom of the Paradise, I worked as a set decorator. Mm-hmm. And I may have been, my heart was in the right place, but I was like, oh my God, this is hard. I was not a set decorator. And Brian, but he thought of me as a really bad set decorator. And so it wasn't doing Carrie. And I got a commercial that for that same day of the tests, the film tests. And I called him and said, Brian, what should I do? I got this commercial. But I want to try out for the film. He said, do the commercial. I think I got a few expletives. And that really motivated me. Mm. I read the book the night, again, the night before the tests. And, you know, that was an interesting experience. But yeah, he held that against me. He didn't think of me as an actor. He thought of me as the world's worst set decorator.
It just so happens, looking back, like literally reading through these Wikipedias, that you and basically like five or six other actresses who have since become like the definitive movie actresses of our time are born within the same couple years of each other. It's like you and Sally Field and Jessica Lange, and I think Meryl's in there, Sigourney Weaver, and Glenn Close. And I was wondering, did you throughout your career feel a particular sense of camaraderie with these people, even though routinely you were nominated against them for Oscars, et cetera?
Very much so. Very much so, camaraderie. Because they're, you know, now they're actors everywhere. and it wasn't such a large industry then. And I don't think we felt, because we were all so different, we didn't feel a competitiveness. And I think, you know, when you either own a role or you don't, and if you don't own it, then it, you know, it will belong to, it will find it's like water finding its way down the creek. And we were all very good friends. I played softball with Sally Field back in the day, you know, in years in Los Angeles. And yeah, so I love being put in that group of artists. I really do. Thank you.
Oh my God, of course. Imagine not putting you in that group. Come on. Yeah, yeah.
Actually, as a side note, Sissy, I wanted to tell you that I'm friends with Ronan Farrow, and when I mentioned that I was doing this interview, he brought up that you are one of Mia's favorite actresses to watch on screen. Like, she absolutely adores watching you in anything, and has for years.
Oh my God, and she's one of my favorites.
I was going to say, you both actually have a kind of comparable thing where, like, you appear on screen and then I feel like some sort of transformation generally happens where you kind of get to shock us with power at some point.
That sounds good.
Yeah. No, I like to watch that. So
she's really wonderful, wonderful actress. She's not working enough now, but it's hard. There are just not as many roles when you're not an ingenue.
Are you somebody who ends up seeing like all the new movies coming out? Are you somebody who likes to keep up on everything, or do you kind of dial in and out of Hollywood from time to time? Since I know you rather purposefully went away, don't live in Hollywood most of the time.
I dial in and out, mostly out at this point. I have grandchildren now, preoccupied. But that's why I was so excited about Night Sky, because of the relationship. And it's so rare to have a whole series to develop the characters and develop a relationship with someone that you've supposedly been married to for 50 years. but you've known each other for 10 minutes when you shoot your first scene. It's very bizarre, but wonderful.
Well, have you found at this point in your career then it is more just sort of exciting for you to do something like A Night Sky, like a Bloodline, you know, like a Homecoming, like a television series where it feels like you're doing a lot of character work in multiple episodes and then it's sort of done as well. And it's less, I guess, a big thing like a film.
You know, that's, it reminds me of the 70s in film. It was, you know, low budget films, the director ruled, it was, you know, the art of it. And it was really magic time in filmmaking. And I think this is a really wonderful time for television, especially for older actors, you know, because now films have to be giant event. They need to be to get people out of their bedrooms and their living rooms. The worst part about television is streaming television is that you give every episode just all of your blood. You just give it everything you've got, and then you're like, oh my God, you finished it. You're so excited about certain scenes, but you never get to like talk to anybody about it because then you get the new script and you carry on. So it's grueling physically. But other than that, it's wonderful. It's wonderful that it's come at this time in my career because I've found so many really interesting roles.
Speaking of that, there's this video by this woman who goes by the name Be Kind Rewind, and she goes through biopic acting in movies, and specifically Coal Miner's Daughter. But she talks about how in your career, and I think this applies to your new TV show too, you have found projects that split the difference between mainstream and auteuristic, you know, where like you get to really convey like a director's strong and strange and different point of view, but it happens to a big audience gets to enjoy it. When you're picking a script, do you look for both of those things, like a strong kind of who's the director, who's going to be doing this, how strange will it be, and yet accessible in a certain way?
Well, you know, in television, in film, yes, because it's all about the director. But in television, it's really about the writers and the creators of the show. They're your fearless leaders. They're the ones who go from, they're there, they know everything. And you have new directors coming in. That can be a little unnerving because you have 2 weeks to do an hour episode, and you've got to work out all the kinks, and you've got to develop a relationship with a new director. And it can also be wonderful because it can kind of shake things up a little bit, but you don't want it to shake things up so much that it throws you off your track. I really love it because you get to know people so well. You know, in a film, it's like 6 weeks, if you're lucky, unless it's a big, huge film, like my husband does, all the big ones. and particularly with people with masks on, you know, the end of the show, people take their masks off. They go, hi, it's like, who are you? Well, hi. You just kind of have to roll with it. I'm grateful to still be working and working with interesting actors and interesting filmmakers and in different genres. I had that experience with Carrie. You know, I thought, oh my God, this is going to be the end of me, and it wasn't. And it's still around here, like 100 years later. There are always tormented teenagers.
Yeah.
I think it's made me, the success of that made me a little braver to do things. I think that's kind of, you know, that's going to be a reach. I don't know, the sci-fi, how do I relate to that? You know, what in my life can prepare me for that? Oh, I'm a human being. I'm just an ordinary human being who finds this thing in her backyard. And so I don't have to do anything. I just have to experience it. So I don't know. I don't know. What was your question?
No, that I thought I explained it well enough. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Lewis brought up Coal Miner's Daughter, and I just recently saw this interview with GQ you did where you were revisiting your iconic roles, and you talked about how that role really sort of stuck with you because you liked doing the accent, you had the band around, you really sort of loved being Loretta Lynn, and it was sad when it was over and you couldn't go back to being her. Were there any other roles in your career where you felt like once you were done with the movie, you were like, damn, I still want to be her? Or like really stuck with you after you were done filming?
Yeah, that was the hard one to let go of. But I didn't want to be that person that was like hanging on after that. I've seen footage of me in interviews and stuff after Coal Miner's Daughter. And that accent, it was really hard to shake. You know, it was hard to let go of. There were different, I didn't have that same experience on any other film that I can think of, but I had, you know, I was changed by different films. In the Bedroom was one that really affected me deeply. And, you know, they're like your children. You love them all, and but they're different. I loved working with David Lynch.
Oh, I love The Straight Story. I wish people talked about that movie. It's such an unusual movie for him, too.
Yes, I said, David, do I have to cut my hair? Here, I can wear a wig. And he's like, no, sis, you gotta cut your hair. I had these great teeth. Oh my goodness. That was really fun.
I'm happy you brought up In the Bedroom because among my friends, that's a movie where like the power still sticks with us. Like your iconic scene, which I believe is part of your Oscars clip too. Just like, we see tons of fights with people on screen, but there's something about that movie where it just nailed it. Like you're really in that family's dynamic. And I don't know, can you talk about filming that movie and like Todd Field, that was his first movie. Like how did this all come together and be so amazing?
So brilliant. You know, that I think that movie cost $1 million. And I remember one of the first days we were in our dressing rooms were in a motel rooms. And I remember like getting dressed and I was like, reached under the bed, whose socks are these? We were using the crew's. You know, it was really like, we're going to put on a show. But Todd is brilliant, and he was just such a joy to work with. Oh my God, he was so and the actor Tom Wilkinson.
Tom Wilkinson,
God.
Of course, yes,
yes,
the great Tom Wilkinson.
Unbelievable, he's a theater actor. He could have like twisted me up and broken me in half, and he was so kind. And then we had that big fight scene where Todd had to start in the kitchen. I'm throwing dishes. And then we go through the whole house. And it was just so right at the height of our explosive fight. The doorbell rang. And it was a Girl Scout selling candy. And of course, he stopped. We stopped the fight, as you would do. Go. Buy the candy. It just was. And Marissa Tomei, oh my God.
An icon.
Wonderful. And I had to slap her. Or I got to slap her. I thought, oh my God, I was slapping her with a backhand, which is just horrible. Just, you know, so dismissive. And I took my rings off. I didn't want to hurt her, but God, she's spectacular. And Tom Wilkinson, if you're listening to this, I forgot your name because I'm old.
We all obviously, you know, like know so many of your iconic roles, and I feel like people are always stopping you to talk about, you know, like, you know, Gary, or like, you know, film fans like Love in the Bedroom, Coal Miner's Daughter. Are there roles of yours that you feel, is there any particular film that you feel like you wish people were still talking about this film now, because you had such a great time on it, you thought it was such an interesting film that maybe didn't get the attention it deserved when it came out?
The Straight Story, maybe. That was that kind of fell through the cracks. But, you know, every film kind of finds its audience, finds its place. You know, working with Terrence Malick on Badlands was like a real life changer for me, because I realized that film could be art. And he was so passionate about every frame, and that there was like a fire inside of him. And that's where I met my husband, Jack Fisk, who was art director, production designer on Badlands. And we fell in love. And so it was this kind of wild, passionate love affair while we were making this film that was, you know, about to change both our lives. And it really made me understand that it's really not about the actors. It's about the director. It's about the script. It's about everybody working on the show. And that was a great thing to learn so early in my career. And that's when I realized it's about the director. And so, and that's really special time in Hollywood in the 70s, where it felt like a smaller film community, and maybe it was because it was just smaller films that studios didn't really care that much about, so they didn't keep an eye on us, and they, you know, if it failed, it wasn't a big loss because there wasn't much invested in it. Most of the films, those films were independent that I did then, and the directors like Scorsese and De Palma and Spielberg and were all friends. And so it was just a neat time. You know, there wasn't so much pressure. It was really just about the work. And that was, you know, like, hey, we're going to put on a show, Mickey Rooney. that's a thing. And the other thing is that nobody's really watching. So you have a freedom to try things and mess up and try things again. And it's when people start to notice you that you start to think, oh my God, you know, how did I do that? I don't know how I did that. Can I do it again? I don't know. Maybe not. So it was really like, it's like starting over every time you work on something. And I've kind of brought that along with me. Unfortunately, it's like, okay, how does this work now? But it works differently because you're working with different directors and they bring out different things in you. It's really exciting. What was your question?
No, you got it. You got it. Yeah. You've worked with truly some of the best directors and some of my faves. You know, I mean, I'm a huge De Palma fan. I'm a huge Lynch fan. Controversial as he is, I love an Oliver Stone movie. And you're fantastic in JFK.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. What a trip, that guy. Oh, my goodness. I went to meet with him. My agent said, okay, now, Oliver's a little different. So just be careful. He's gonna try to throw you off right away. So just watch it. Watch out. So I went and I had a great meeting with him, and I came back and my agent said, "Well, how did it go?" I went, "It was great." He said, "Well, did he try to pull the rug out from under you? Did he pull anything?" And I said, "No." He said, "Well, what happened?" I said, "Well," he said, "So what was the first thing he said to you?" "Hi, sissy, I hear you want to rewrite the script." And I said, "No, just my part." I didn't know enough to be intimidated. And I think that was, you know, maybe that was it.
Well, I will take your word for it that the directors are run the show on a movie. But when we have talents like you, it's really hard to believe you don't run the whole thing and that the all the light in the room doesn't just bend towards you naturally. So thank you so much for being here today with us.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it so much.
And I love the show, too. And I love you and JK together. What an awesome pairing we get.
Yeah.
He's quite an individual.
Oh, yeah?
No matter calls for, he's in it to win it. He's great. Love him. Yeah, and I'm so glad.
I love that.
Joe, thank you.
Of course.
Yeah. I mean, it must be, I mean, it's amazing this point in your career still getting to work with like exciting actors who you haven't worked with before, like J.K. Simmons. So congrats. It's a great show. Night Sky premieres on Amazon Prime Video on May 20th. To prepare for our lovely interview with the icon, Sissy Spacek, we went back to watch some of her films and discovered some of our own blind spots in her filmography. I love when we do a blind spot segment because I always get to watch a movie that I've either randomly missed or something that I've always been meaning to watch. And my blind spot is so weird. Because it's In the Bedroom, which I would have thought I'd seen in 2001 when it came out, specifically because I was in high school then. And I feel like In the Bedroom was definitely, maybe for our age group, maybe you had this similar sort of situation happening, Lewis. But I felt like the kids who were like into films at my high school, like this was a movie that they started talking about. Like there were certain films between 2000 and 2004 that like, you know, like the kids who were like, not just like, I'm going to the movies to see a movie. The kids who were like, I like cinema would like start.
Oh, see, no, I did not know anybody like that. I had to invent that for myself.
Oh, really?
In 2001, I went with all my friends to see things like Rat Race or Too Fast, Too Furious or whatever was happening.
I went by myself, but then like, you know, the art nerds that I was friends with, like on the weekend, like we would watch Pi.
Oh, but by the way, okay, this is a specific memory. Now I'm thinking of my girlfriend Elise, but people our age would have DVD collections, you know, that were about 15 deep. And they all, at least I'm thinking of my friend, but this is something I would see over and over again. They all had this like moody, dark whimsy about them. It was movies like Pi and Donnie Darko and Requiem for a Dream. Virgin Suicides.
Was constantly being watched by fucking people. And I was like, by the fourth time someone was like, let's put on Requiem for a Dream, I'm like, this movie makes me want to slit my wrists.
It is not a fun time. I am not the same after watching what happens to Jennifer Connelly. Anyway, In the Bedroom is one of two movies directed by Todd Field. It's that and Little Children, which is a masterpiece. These are both quote unquote domestic movies. They take place in smaller towns, and Sissy Spacek gets I would compare it to Esther Roll, the smashing the plates on the ground sort of version of Cacophony. And it really is a fabulous drama.
It really is. And I would say that drama is the correct word for it. This is, this is like drama that feels a bit more realistic than, you know, sort of like what I'm drawn to, like a melodrama. It's not giving Sir, you know, it's not giving Todd Haynes. This is, it feels more quaint. It feels more lived in. And even though you can sort of see that, like, something, you know, something bad is about to happen. It has like the melodramatic turn, you know, of Nick Stahl getting shot in the head by Marissa Tomei's baby daddy. But after that, you know, it doesn't go into sweeping melodrama. You know, it's still it. You just get sort of like the human element of this tragedy, and I actually did not see that coming. I actually thought, I actually was thinking maybe it was going to veer more towards like a melodrama. I thought if it were a melodrama, they would have killed the abusive baby daddy. And maybe like, I thought they were going to kill the abusive baby daddy. And then like Sissy Spacek and Tom Wilkinson were going to help cover up a murder.
And I watched 9 to 5 recently, so that's they don't murder him in that, but anyway.
But this was it was really, really fucking good. And I'd seen Little Children before. So I'd seen Todd Field's work. It was just really sort of a beautiful film. I mean, I don't know what else to say about it besides the fact that it's just like well written, well directed. Sissy and Tom Wilkinson are just sort of like an amazing duo in that film. We were talking about that when we interviewed her, you know, sort of like how great she is with the leading men that she's gotten to work with over the years, you know, like a Tom Wilkinson and, you know, J.K. Simmons on Night Sky. And I have enough class that I did not ask her about working with Christopher Walken on the film Blast from the Past. But I really wanted to.
Oh, my God. A movie, a movie I've seen like 30 times and I can't explain why. I watched The Straight Story, which is a movie directed by David Lynch in the late 90s that feels very out of step with a lot of what David Lynch does, which is it's never going for absurdity in any way. It's not even like The Elephant Man, which has a sort of gothic feel to it. But it does tap into David Lynch's transcendental meditation brain. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's about a guy who takes a trip on his lawnmower through Iowa up to Wisconsin to see his dying brother. And it's really as simple as that. Richard Farnsworth, who also great in a Jane Fonda movie called Comes a Horseman in the 70s, he is the star of this. And Sissy Spacek plays his daughter, who she has like a sort of speech impediment where she talks in a sort of hiccupy cadence, and they say she's intellectually disabled, but they don't really get into it. Man, first of all, as somebody who went to the University of Iowa, no movie set in Iowa is more beautiful. And I'm looking at you, Field of Dreams. You're in second place. they really sell you on the beauty of that state. And as they should, because I think people think of Iowa as just flat and, you know, drab looking, when no, that's the rest of Illinois. Mm. Because Illinois has Chicago in it, we really give that whole state a pass. No, Illinois is not cute. Iowa, gorgeous.
I actually don't think of Iowa.
Okay, well, get on it. But the music in it is so lovely. It's just one of those things where we made a really auteuristic, strange guy make a kind of conventional movie. And because he's so committed to his brand of artistry, it ends up being this transcendent film. It is so, so good. It's not my favorite David Lynch movie. That would definitely be Mulholland Drive, but just excellent performances.
It'd be weird if it was, but fucking love David Lynch. And Angelo Badalamenti did the score for this, and they've worked together since Blue Velvet. And it's so weird to know you're watching a David Lynch film and to hear Angelo's, you know, score startup, you know, which is evoking Blue Velvet, is evoking Twin Peaks, and then come into this film. And even the beginning of the film seems like, okay, you know, like it's not, you know, there's not grotesque characters in it, but the characters feel more human than sort of you know, Hollywood Fair, you know, like they seem like real people from the Midwest. So you're yes. like, oh, you're going to get mm-hmm. some like Midwestern oddities, and you get a bit of that, but you really don't veer into anything that you sort of really know David Lynch for. And it's
no, there's one character in this movie who he runs into while he's driving the lawnmower, who this woman hits a deer and she gets out of the car and she starts screaming, "This is the 14th deer I've hit in 3 weeks," or something. And it's meant to be, I think, a shocking, a joltingly comic moment, which does remind me of Twin Peaks a little bit. But even that, it seems like a real person. Her exasperation is real. You don't leave it thinking like, oh, that was, you know, bizarre camp in the way that you would feel about a Twin Peaks cameo. Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's what's interesting about it is that it's actually, you know, like a biographical film. You know, it's based on
it's based on a real story.
And I think that maybe that's what makes it so different, you know, when Lynch's oeuvre, you know, it's just sort of him respecting the actual story and what happened and not putting his own spin on it. I really like to read more about you know, what he thinks of this film now. I mean, it was nominated for the Palme d'Or, you know. And it's also the first positive review that Ebert ever gave a Lynch film. He gave it 4 out of 4 stars,
which is interesting.
Listen, Ebert will like trash and be like, you know what, had a good time. 3 out of 4 stars, or he'll see a movie like A Blue Velvet or an Eraserhead, and he'll be like, what the fuck is this?
I do love, I was just missing Roger Ebert recently. Like, if I'm watching a movie from, you know, 2012 or earlier, I tend to read his review again. And the zest of his writing, the unpretentiousness of his writing, but I do love his weird sticking points, like his whole thing about video games, how they could never be the level of art that cinema is for certain strange criteria he put together. But good, I like a codgerliness about my film critics.
I think it was Disturbia, the movie that I saw in theaters with Roger Ebert. I need to recall which one it was. I need to look it up in our school paper, but one time I reviewed a film for Loyola University, like school newspaper, and the screening I was sent to downtown was one of the same screenings that Ebert was at in the front.
Oh my gosh.
I spent most of the movie looking at Ebert.
No, I would. I am sure he had no reaction whatsoever. He's so used. You can't shock him at a movie. No, one time I was at Century City, and I passed Leonard Maltin walking in.
You're king.
As you know, I have a disease where I can recall the star ratings Leonard Maltin gives most movies, because I would get the book he put out every year. And I went up to him and I said, this sounds so crazy, but I have an incredible memory for these star ratings you've given movies over the years. Like, if you said a movie, I would know. Like, I know Braveheart's 3.5. I know, you know, I know you gave 2.5 to Forrest Gump. And let me tell you, it's a 2.5-star movie. You were right to do that. He responded with thank you and walked away like I was a GD goblin, which I understand.
Have you ever interviewed Maltin?
No, I know his daughter reached out to me one time. She had heard that I had this Jones for his rating, and she told him, she said he was delighted, but I know he's scared, and that's fine.
This is your misery.
Yes.
You hold them captive. You're like, I need to know what you think of these recent movies, Leonard.
Code is a 2.5. Say it. Yeah.
My other blind spot was Badlands, which was Terrence Malick's directorial debut. And
yeah, put him on the map.
You know, yeah. I mean, it's wild that like your first feature film like puts you on the map. You know, but it's really a gorgeous film. I mean, when you talk about how the straight story made like Iowa look so gorgeous, right? Like, this is about like Martin Sheen and Sissy Spacek play a couple that go on the run after he shoots her father, and then they burn the house down and go on the run. And he's sort of like in his 20s and she's 15. They go on the run across America, and it is so gorgeous. You know, it reminded me, you know, a sort of like Nomadland. You know, like it was like so beautiful and lush, and seeing, you know, just sort of like what this the American landscape looked like in 1973, like, you know, like the swamp and the marshes and the woods that he shoots in. It's just, it's so beautiful to watch, and it really is sort of like a meditation of a film. Like, it would be classified as a neo-noir, but it's not really very salacious. Yeah, it's not Queen and Slim for white people, you know?
Which I'm always needing. I'm like, can we get the Queen and Slim for like white people? I want to say also about this story in the movie, it's about the killer Charlie Starkweather, which he's probably most famously chronicled on the Bruce Springsteen album Nebraska, which there's a whole song about him, and like that album is about the, you know, the grimness of being in Nebraska in the middle of the country and, you know, being alone with your disturbing thoughts and things like that.
Baby, Springsteen was in his bag on Nebraska, okay?
Oh, fuck yeah. Oh, no. He's like, oh, you think I'm just writing like big anthems for your uncle? Absolutely not. I'm unfuckwittable, shall we say. It is that album is not a joke.
I love hearing you say unfuckwittable.
you know I'm a Springsteen fan. Reason to Believe on that album. Does It Get Darker? And I love Amy Mann's cover with her husband, Michael Penn.
I don't know why I didn't place that this was inspired by the Starkweather case, but I know the Starkweather case inspired Natural Born Killers as well.
Yes, of course.
Which is definitely a film.
Right.
I don't love Natural Born Killers the way that I think that some people do. It's like, it's one of my lesser Oliver Stone films. And I do like Oliver Stone.
No. Oh, as we discovered in our Sissy interview, or you will discover in our Sissy interview if you haven't listened to that part yet. The other movie I watched was Three Women, which, can I just say something about the films of Robert Altman? You basically have to be taught to seek this man out, because with the exception of Gosford Park, over the past 25 years, there's just it's just somebody that like the Criterion Channel points you at, and you need someone to say, watch all these movies. This movie is so good, and I cannot believe we had a movie starring Sissy Spacek and Shelley Duvall. I mean, the eye size in this movie is just unprecedented. That we would put them both together. And as my friend said, I was telling one of my girlfriends, can you believe that Sissy Spacek and Shelley Duvall, arguably the definitive eyes of the 70s, if they added Karen Black, it would have been perfect. and she goes, wait, she goes, Sissy Spacek and Shelley Duvall, were they nightgown salesmen? Come on, that joke. Yes. I'm going to say nothing else about that movie other than watch it. Sissy's performance and her turn in it, slay.
You know, I think that I would also sort of classify Terrence Malick as sort of one of those directors. I mean, I know he makes a lot more films.
Yeah, oh, but, definitely. You know, Days of Heaven, another movie that is gorgeous to look at from the 70s by Terrence
Malick. Yeah, they're both sort of directors from that era who, you know, you need the real film buffs, or the Criterion Collection holders to be talking about. And that they're always people who are sort of like mentioned when people, you know, want to only talk about like Scorsese. You know, I'm talking about film Twitter, not actual film buffs. Yeah. But Malick,
I wouldn't know. Film Twitter hates me, so I don't see much.
We know they hate both of us. Terrence Malick and Robert Altman are really like, I feel like they are directors who you sort of have to be like, I'm gonna sit and watch this movie. You know, you sort of have to, I agree with you, have sort of to teach yourself to watch them. I mean, like, I saw recently A Hidden Life by Malick, which is, you know, about you know, an Austrian farmer who refuses to fight for the Nazis in World War II. I watched it because one of the actors in it is Franz Rogowski, who's just in this great gay film that I just watched, Great Freedom. I don't know if you've seen that.
No.
That movie was about how it was illegal to be gay in like post Nazi Germany, and like people would be locked up for it. And it spans him over decades being locked up repeatedly and sort of like developing relationships with different men in prison. It's beautiful. And I think he's regarded as like one of the sort of best German actors sort of ever. He's great. So watch A Hidden Life if you haven't seen it. But Altman and Malick are definitely people with a lot of blind spots. I actually haven't seen Three Women.
Oh my God. I mean also just like Shelley Duvall, just as a beguiling one-of-a-kind presence. Obviously people know her most from The Shining, but she's in a ton of Altman movies. She's of course in Popeye.
Was this before or after The Shining?
Before The Shining. Oh, before The Shining.
So before she was emotionally wrecked
by Stanley Kubrick. Yeah. I can we get the definitive account of how horrible he could be to actors? I mean, it couldn't have just been that movie. You know, we talked to Alan Cumming quickly about the amount of time he put into filming Eyes Wide Shut, the 30 seconds he's in that movie, and it sounded like he lost 2 years of his life. So
we need a film like that Hitchcock film, which was, you know, supposed to depict his relationship with Janet Leigh. I would like to see Kubrick. Who would play Kubrick? Adam Driver?
Oh, now you said it. Wait for it.
He'd gain weight for the role, definitely.
Yeah,
true. I feel like he has the like steely face, you know, and like the wispy sort of hair.
The intensity too. Yeah.
Or Leo.
No, Adam Driver, you know he's going to have two Oscars in, I'm going to say, 15 years.
Okay.
Check back with me then.
I would say him or Leo.
Oh, well, I mean, if Leo wants to do it, then he'll
Who
do it.
Who plays Shelley Duvall?
Oh, now that we should be able to figure out. Mia Goth. Done.
Okay.
I love it when I know. There we go.
And you know what? She's perfect for the role because, you know, she's expecting a child with Shia LaBeouf.
So
I think she's
expectedly haunted.
I think she's been through her own Shining.
Right. She's done some running through some hedge mazes, if you will.
Okay, yes. Her mind's in Disturbia. To bring up the movie I talked about
Disturbia?
Earlier.
Disturbia? Can I say about Disturbia quickly and then we'll move on? I actually, first, a movie that is just Rear Window, it is, I think, entertaining enough, and Shia LaBeouf is really good in it. Does that bastard whose house they're looking into, does he not have fucking alligators in a pit or something over there? Come on, obviously you can't do that.
You know
what is it in here? It's like Devil in the White City. It's also like a Discovery Zone. Like, what is happening in this house?
First of all, Devil in the White City. I worked at Borders in Chicago when we were in college. The chokehold that book had on people. Everybody was reading Devil in the White City. I can't believe an adaptation hasn't come out yet.
I think there was supposed to be one. I forget if it might have even been Leo that was attached initially. Of course, can you believe it? Well, like psycho intense guy. He signed up.
Yeah. I mean, it's just one of those books where I feel like even people who don't really read books that often, like everybody was fucking reading Devil in the White City. But
no, people would just show up to a Borders and shrug and say, this is the book I'm supposed to have. Yeah.
And as someone who worked there, you know, like you'd always get different variations of the title. White Devil in the City. I'm looking for the devil book. They're like,
Babe, White Devil in the City. Yes. My favorite White Devil, Babe.
Next week, we'll talk about how Babe was a white supremacist pig.
The sheep pig. Yeah, guess what wool he was wearing.
Okay,
it was a robe.
The great farming theory is what Babe wants to teach you about.
farming theory.
By the way, the evil neighbor in Disturbia was David Morse, who
Right. Crazy role
who
for him.
I just saw on stage in How I Learned to Drive. He plays the uncle who sort of, you know, like molests Mary Louise Parker in Paula Vogel's How I Learned to Drive.
By the way, I've decided about Mary Louise Parker that, one, I will be seeing this production. Two, when she is in a play, I like follow her around the country fish style. I think she is that one of a kind and worth it.
She is. I mean, I feel like she's the, it's weird that she and Sam Rockwell are both on Broadway at the moment, because I feel like they're very similar as actors, like at least to me in my heart. You know, they both have a weird quirk. And I would also follow them both to the ends of the earth, you know? And you know how many fucking movies I've watched where Sam Rockwell plays a white supremacist just because I love him? I watched that movie with Taraji and that wig.
Oh my God, I forgot all about that movie. No, Mary Louise Parker is like the Yale of Sandy Dennis's, who is in a poster behind me. You know, they've got the tics, they've got the neurosis, but it's also soulful and also fucking real. Like there's just something about the way she expresses herself where you're getting a full person immediately. And also, of course, it's a Pulitzer Prize winning play. I should just see it anyway.
Well, they just extended it, so you should go see it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right, New York, I'm coming. So
watch out.
Watch out. I'm always obsessed with on Twitter when they're like, somebody will be like, they make fun of gays who say, they aren't ready for us this summer. And then, oh, they're not ready for you in your shorts and a Honda Civic. Always so funny. Yeah.
Ty T's not ready for Lewis.
It's specifically ready for me. Everybody looks like me.
All right. When we're back, keep it. And we're back with our favorite segment of the episode. It's Keep It. Lewis, why don't you go first?
Yes. Sorry, I'm being like David Lynch and I'm just meditating on mine for a moment. My Keep It pertains to Grindr, which I did a rant on Grindr on Kimmel last week. Maybe you saw it. I sort of gave a PG-13 rundown of what happens on Grindr, you know, for people like my mom who are perpetually, you know, clutching at their collar like the white guy in the Baby Got Back video. So I've decided to pick a classic Grindr happening to critique for my Keep It this week. My Keep It is to people who message you and instead of saying hi or just being nice, they immediately criticize how you handle your body hair. The amount of people who are like, oh, that's too bad that you shaved that, or it's too bad that you didn't shave that. It's like, girl, I didn't realize I was fucking artwork for you to critique. It's such a strange, pernicious thing that I feel like all of my friends have experienced, where people just decide you want to hear grooming tips from a complete stranger. Now, obviously, there's a lot of overstepping of bounds in lots of directions. Lots of people on Grindr still post things like, whatever, no Asians, or just straight up blatantly racist things. So there's worse things occurring on Grindr. But this as a particular nuisance is so strange to me. I wonder what it is about body hair that makes people think you want to hear the correct answer about how to handle it.
You know, I've always thought that you were a piece of art to critique, Lewis. I think of you as Venus de Milo.
Oh, as in, you want to rip my arms off.
Yeah, I don't know. I have a very hairy chest, so I've never experienced that.
I feel like people are, there's always been this line of thought like, oh, real men are hairy or something. Meanwhile,
they are.
Meanwhile, you get a fucking haircut, don't you? So why would any other hair be different than the hair on your head?
Because Samson
lost his
power when he cut his hair, but his chest hair remained intact and gave him the power of being a man. I don't know where I was going with that.
No, you wrapped into evangelicalism in a way that made me think of someone like Ianla.
Criticizing body hair? Not on my watch.
What a great celebrity. I miss her.
Where is she? You say that like she's in the gulag now.
I don't know where she is. I feel like I haven't heard from her recently.
That's your Keep It this week?
Yeah, that's it. Be nice to each other on Grindr. Also, everybody needs a picture of some kind. I don't care if it's not your face. The blank shit, that's got to go.
You know, they are creepy. My biggest pet peeve is, like, I will get a message from someone with a blank, like, no profile. And they're like, how's it going?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm good. And I'll always respond something with, like, stranger or, like, mysterious person with no photo. And they'll, like, laugh it off and keep talking, or they'll just go silent.
No. Nobody wants to get deeply unidentifiable text. You ever seen the movie Personal Shopper? It's bone chilling.
Yeah. I mean, have you ever seen Confessions of a Shopaholic? Also bone chilling.
Yes.
I don't know.
but very grittily real. Yeah.
But Grindr is featured heavily in that movie.
I'm sure it's not. So
it could be. Have you ever seen it? Let's visit that blind.
Have I seen
Let's
it?
Visit
yes.
That blind spot, Lewis.
No, I've seen Confessions of a Shopaholic.
Isla Fisher's greatest work.
Ira, what's your keep it?
My keep it this week, unfortunately, goes to my vanilla king, Jack Harlow, and his new album, Come Home, The Kids Miss You.
The vanilla king, period. I mean, who else is even competing with him at the moment?
Yeah, I feel like I always have a new one, though. You know, like, it used to be Charlie Puth. Now it's Jack Harlow.
Well, if he's not going to put out that album, he's not our vanilla king. So,
well, and here's my thing. Jack Harlow shouldn't have put out his album.
Oh, I see.
Maybe Charlie Puth is the superior vanilla king because he is not putting out his work for scrutiny. Jack Harlow's new album, Come Home, The Kids Miss You, is adequate. I listen. It's literally the definition of I like the beat. Because, listen, Pharrell is doing some crazy shit on this album. You know, like, Justin Timberlake is on the album. And, you know what? I'm also coming out of, Justin Timberlake fan witness protection. I can't do it anymore. I like Justin Timberlake. I'm sorry. I listen to 2020 constantly. I do. I felt like I really had to hate him because of what he did to Britney and to Janet. But, I like him.
Okay, the fans are now flipping through the hundreds of episodes we've done talking about our disdain for Justin Timberlake. So this reversal is feeling a little haunted to me.
You know what? Maybe that's my real keep it. My real keep it is to having to hide the fact that I like Justin Timberlake's music. I don't like
him. You love the man in the woods, and I wish you would disappear into the woods. That's where you belong now.
I don't like him that much. He can be very annoying. But the music... Baby, the albums are great. Two perfect albums. Two perfect albums.
Wait, Future Sex Love
Future
Sounds?
Future Sex Love Sounds and Justified.
Oh, early ones. Okay. Well, let me say something about Future Sex Love Sounds. What continues to bother me about that album is he was clearly copying the naming structure of Speaker Box The Love Below. But the deal with that album was it was two albums. So him taking the slash is just senseless and contrived.
All right.
Next album. What's up now? Disappointing.
But anyway, like getting back to Jack Harlow, I think an album specifically by a rapper to sort of tell you something about them. And I don't feel like I really learned anything about Jack Harlow on this album. It sort of feels very blank, like anybody could have rapped this, you know. Like, I thought he was so interesting as, like, a rapper who hopped on Lil Nas X's Industry Baby song. Like, I love to hear, like, what he thinks, you know, about, you know, being thrust, you know, into, like, gay culture like that, you know. I mean, he has a song called Dua Lipa on the album, which, you know, is like, has the line, Dua Lipa trying to do more with her than get a feature, you know, which, so you're attracted to Dua Lipa, cool, who isn't? What else is going on? There are a couple songs I like, but overall, like, it's sort of forgettable, and that's unfortunate because he was one of the, like, most exciting new rappers to sort of come out recently. Anyway, getting back to the fact that we're now living in a post me admitting I love Justin Timberlake world.
I know. I feel shattered. Yeah. I think, well, it's going to be jail time for you. Me, I will continue doing what I do, which is getting iced coffee.
That's our show this week. Thank you to Sissy Spacek for joining us, and we'll see you next week. Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our senior producer is Kendra James. Our producer is Chris Lord. Our executive producers are Ira Madison III
and Louis Fertel.
Our editor is Charlotte Landis, and Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer.
Thank you to our digital team, Matt DeGroot, Nara Malkonian, and Delon Villanueva for our production support every week.